I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. The investigation into the shooting death of Trayvon Martin takes place almost a year after another high-profile Central Florida criminal case, Casey Anthony's. This week on Intersection, Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab joins me to discuss how the two criminal cases are similar and how they're different. Plus, we'll hear a report from 90.7's Matthew Petty on the challenges Central Florida seniors face getting around when they can't drive. That's ahead on Intersection. Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab is following the Trayvon Martin case. She recently compared the performance of two high-profile attorneys in two high-profile trials. One is attorney Mark O'Mara, who is defending the shooter in the Martin case, George Zimmerman. Kassab compared O'Mara's efforts to famed lawyer Clarence Darrow, who worked on the Scopes Monkey trial. She compared somewhat less flatteringly Jose Baez, the defense attorney for Casey Anthony, to Lionel Hutz, a frequently bumbling attorney from early episodes of The Simpsons.
Hey, yeah, who are you? I saw you chasing Bart's ambulance.
Hutz is the name, Mr. Simpson. Lionel Hutz, attorney at law. Here's my card. It turns into a sponge when you put it in water.
Ooh, classy.
I'd like to talk to you about bringing legal action against the fiend who did this to your boy.
And here to talk about how Lionel Hutz, The Simpsons, the Casey Anthony case, and the Trayvon Martin case all come together is Beth Kassab. Beth, good to have you back in.
Thanks for having me.
So you made an interesting comparison here between two high-profile cases that Central Florida has seen. One of those, the Casey Anthony case, and of course the Trayvon Martin case. And in both of those situations, you had the attorneys in the cases really stepping into the public spotlight and getting a lot of scrutiny. In the Trayvon Martin case, Mark O'Mara is representing George Zimmerman, who is the Sanford neighborhood watchman who shot and killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. In the Casey Anthony case, Jose Baez represented Anthony, who was acquitted last summer of first-degree murder in the death of her 2-year-old daughter. So these two attorneys have taken very different tacks in terms of their public personas and public perceptions. Why did you write about it?
Well, I thought the comparison was really interesting. They struck me as two very different attorneys in both their experience and their demeanor and in how they were handling the media. O'Mara is more experienced than Baez was at the time that Baez began representing Casey Anthony. And I think that, you know, their demeanor does set a tone for how these cases are going to play out.
You know, one element that is uniquely different between the Trayvon Martin case and the Casey Anthony case is that we've actually heard George Zimmerman speak on his own behalf. And we never heard Casey Anthony speak. It always was Jose Baez speaking for Casey Anthony.
That's right. And that was certainly Jose Baez's legal strategy. And it was certainly Casey Anthony's right to not speak during her trial or during any of the hearings and machinations that led up to her trial. And we all are afforded that protection. So that was certainly her right. I think, though, by putting George Zimmerman on the stand at his bond hearing, I think Mark O'Mara accomplished a few really good things. And it's a strategy that very much could have backfired. And I think it was a risk to do it. But O'Mara made the calculated risk and he did it. And by putting him on the stand, he allowed George Zimmerman to apologize in his own words. That apology was not well received by Trayvon Martin's parents, and I can certainly understand why. But I think it was important for the public to hear from George Zimmerman and to hear that he is sorry, to hear that he did say that he didn't know that Trayvon Martin was as young as he was. He didn't know whether he was armed or not. You know, I think more evidence will come out to support, you know, whether or not that apology was sincere or not. But I think most people who heard it said, wow, you know, at least he took that step. And then, you know, the other thing that putting him on the stand did, it caught the prosecutors off guard. And they were then able to question George Zimmerman, but that, you know, nothing really came of that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassib. I'm Mark Simpson. What's your take on the case against George Zimmerman? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter. You can also email us at WMFE.org/intersection. Let's talk about some of the laws and issues and the cast of characters that we're seeing in the periphery of the Trayvon Martin case here. Trayvon Martin's shooting has inspired a nationwide reexamination of gun laws and opened up discussions about race relations. Florida's own Stand Your Ground law is under scrutiny. And I wonder, what do you think is going to be the relationship between this case as it unfolds and the reviews that happen of Florida's Stand Your Ground law? Right now, there's a Florida State Commission looking at it.
Right. There are a few ways in which this law is being reviewed. One is a panel that has been appointed by the governor. One is a panel that is operating independently by another lawmaker, Chris Smith.
Former Democratic leader in the House, now a state senator in Tallahassee.
Correct. There are some national interest groups that are looking at this law. And one interesting review as well, as I understand when I last talked to the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys in Florida, that would be the group of all the state attorneys, all the prosecutors in the state, they are trying to make some tallies about how often this law is being used, how often they believe it's interfering in prosecutions, that sort of thing. So I think that's going to be an interesting review to watch as well.
It's going to be interesting to see how those panels proceed. But on the periphery edges, you've still got the attorneys for both sides in the Trayvon Martin case who are going to be under scrutiny in terms of how do they use the Stand Your Ground law in the actual legal proceedings. So I wonder, what do you think in terms of how's Mark O'Mara going to be using Stand Your Ground versus the state? And then also you've got Benjamin Crump, who's representing Trayvon Martin's family and has been very much in the public spotlight talking about these various laws and issues.
Well, we've gotten a few clues about this, and I think we're going to get more sooner rather than later. And that's because under the Stand Your Ground law, the defense gets to have a hearing. If they use this as a defense, they'll be able to have a hearing with the judge relatively soon before trial, and they'll be able to ask the judge to go ahead and throw the case out based on Stand Your Ground. And O'Mara may, in fact, do that in this case, and we'd be able to hear at that point everything he presents. Now, Angela Corey, the prosecutor who was appointed in this case, she has said a couple of things about Stand Your Ground that I thought were interesting. She appeared on the Nancy Grace Show. It was just maybe a week or two after she was appointed in this case. And she was asked about Stand Your Ground, and she said, you know, one, it has to be, in order to use Stand Your Ground, it's got to be a forcible felony. So the person that you're using the force against has to be committing a forcible felony. And two, it has to be equal force, meeting force with force. So she used the example of a woman in her jurisdiction in Jacksonville who was slapped by her husband, hand across the face slap, and the woman picked up a gun and shot her husband and killed him. She prosecuted that woman for murder, and that woman went to prison because a gunshot didn't necessarily wasn't necessarily equal to a slap across the face, or at least that's what we can gather from the comments she made. So that gives you a little bit of insight into what her strategy might be going forward on this case.
Talk to me a little bit about what's happening in the city of Sanford itself, Beth. Last week, there was a contentious city commission meeting where ostensibly the city commission was going to be deciding whether or not to accept the resignation of embattled police chief Billy Lee. There was a very hot debate about that issue. And very interestingly, the commission actually voted to reject the police chief's resignation. And we're seeing some fracturing appear on the city leadership level in Sanford. You've got the city manager, Norton Bonaparte, who's under a lot of pressure, and also, of course, Mayor Jeff Triplett. What do you see as evolving in Sanford's leadership circles?
Well, they are basically stuck right now. They've said, as you mentioned, the police chief offered his resignation. And I think a lot of people watching the case thought, well, they've already issued a vote of no confidence in the police chief. That was a few weeks ago. Then certainly they'll now accept his resignation. And they didn't do that. They said they wanted to wait and see what the investigation into the investigation bears out. So they're really stuck. They've got to wait now for a few months and see what this review of the police department's handling of Trayvon Martin's death really shows. How did they handle that case? How did they work the case? Did they do what they were supposed to do? Did they look at everything they should have looked at before they decided they wouldn't charge George Zimmerman on the night of the killing? So, you know, that's going to take a while. And until that bears out, they've got some that, you know, they're going to be at the same point. They're looking for an interim leader of the police department. And so far, they don't have one.
You know, with a high profile moment like this, public officials like the city manager, Norton Bonaparte, and of course, Sanford Mayor Jeff Triplett, can both emerge from this in a very strong fashion by exhibiting leadership, or something like this could get out of control and could really end up putting a stop to their careers in terms of politics in the future. What do you think is going to happen up in Sanford for these two individuals who are in such the public spotlight?
Well, it's a little tough to tell. I think Jeff Triplett, the mayor in Sanford, has done a good job so far of trying to be responsive and to be and he's been accessible. He's, you know, Corinne Brown. If you remember, one of the largest rallies in Sanford after Trayvon Martin's death, it was the first rally where Al Sharpton came to town, and Jeff Triplett got up on stage. He was behind the microphone. He was talking, and he was basically booed off the stage. And Corinne Brown got up on the stage and said, "Listen, everybody here needs to know that Mayor Triplett has flown to Washington on very short notice. He's done everything we've asked to do. He was critical in getting the release of the 911 tapes. He has been very responsive in this case. So I think that he deserves credit for that. How he handles things going forward, I don't know. I think whether Sanford, you know, the city still has stable leadership, the city manager is still in place. Are things in a little bit of an upheaval at the police department? Yes, they are. And that needs to be, that will be handled, I guess, over the next few months.
You mentioned that big rally that Corinne Brown, Al Sharpton, Mayor Triplett, many other figures were at. And that was part of the Trayvon Martin movement calling for justice. There was a lot of anger at that time. There were even some revenge feelings, I think, that were rippling through the community, maybe not in the majority of people, but there certainly was all of those elements at play. Where do you see the Trayvon Martin movement heading now that they've gotten their objective achieved, which was the arrest of George Zimmerman?
Right. The main action that they were calling for was the arrest and charging of George Zimmerman. And that has happened. Angela Corey, the special prosecutor, was very explicit on the night that she announced the second-degree murder charge against George Zimmerman. She said, "We do not prosecute by petition or by political pressure." But certainly, I think it goes without saying that movement and bringing the amount of attention that it did to the case certainly helped influence the level of investigation that went on. Now, what happens to that movement now? I think there are several components of it, and I think we're going to have to wait and see how involved they remain as the case moves forward. And I would expect a good number of people involved to remain involved and to watch this case play out, to be perhaps watchdogs on the case like the media has been.
That's Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab. Beth, thanks for coming in and sharing your insights.
Well, thanks for having me.
Coming up, a report from 90.7's Matthew Petty on transportation for seniors in Central Florida. Florida has more than 3 million residents over the age of 65, and that's the highest percentage of senior citizens of any state in the U.S. One challenge facing Florida's graying population is how to get out and about. 90.7's Matthew Petty reports that in Orlando, private companies, public transit, and volunteers are all trying to provide mobility options for seniors.
More than 500,000 drivers in Florida are 81 or older, but as drivers age and hang up the car keys for good, they can find themselves stuck at home. In Orlando, some 300 seniors use the Independent Transportation Network private car service. Bea Chernock rides with ITN a couple of times a week. Today, she's off to the Orlando Regional Medical Center for a checkup.
You in?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go.
Bea Chernock has been using ITN for about 5 years, and not only for doctor's visits.
Everything, from my hairdresser down to here I'm going for blood work. Last week, on a Sunday, they took me to the car auditorium. I saw an opera. They picked me up, and I wasn't afraid. That's the whole thing, you know?
Chernock says ordinarily she wouldn't go out at night, but she feels safe with ITN drivers like John McAllister. McAllister started volunteering after he retired about 3 years ago, and he now drives for the service 5 days a week.
So when I signed on, I asked them to keep me busy, which they have done. And since then, I've driven about 30,000 miles. After 3 years and 3.5 years, of, you know, you pick up the same people every week. Boy, you know, you become a family. It all becomes a family, you know.
After a short ride, McAllister drops Chernock off at the Orlando Regional Medical Center on Orange Ave.
Thank you so much.
Hospitals are a major destination for ITN drivers, according to Executive Director Kimber Threet. Orange Avenue is a popular stop.
Obviously, when you're offering this type of service, and our target market is definitely seniors, and they typically have a need for medical services, we have included all of the medical buildings, especially down Orange Avenue here in Orlando. That's where all of your main hotspots are.
Starting in 2014, seniors will have more transportation options in the medical corridor. They'll be able to take advantage of the Sunrail commuter train stop at Florida Hospital on North Orange. Taxis are also part of the transportation mix for seniors, but Threet says ITN's average trip length of 3.5 miles isn't financially attractive to many cab drivers.
Taxis are wonderful in our community, but they got to make their money, and you don't make a lot on a 3.5-mile run, especially when you're in competition with Disney, which is, that's a $30, $3. It's no-brainer.
An average ride with ITN costs about $9, and there's also a $60 annual membership fee. That's too much for some, but public mass transit does provide an alternative. Central Florida's Lynx bus service operates a fleet of minivans and cars for its Access Lynx door-to-door service. More than 11,000 people, not just seniors, use it. But Director Bill Herndon admits Access Lynx isn't perfect.
We're out there traveling in the same congestion that everyone else is. If there's an accident on I-4, our day's shot. You know, if it rains, traffic tie-ups happen throughout the service area and our on-time performance is down the drain. On the converse side of that, we have customers who, if it weren't for our service, would be stuck at home, would be shut in.
Herndon says there isn't enough money to meet demand for the door-to-door service. Access Lynx already turns down 2,000 applicants a year.
As you know, Lynx doesn't have a dedicated funding source. So every year we literally have to go begging for funding.
That leaves churches, synagogues, mosques and other community groups working to fill a growing transportation need. Peggy Stickle organises a car service with close to 100 volunteer drivers at St. Margaret Mary Catholic Church in Winter Park. Her model doesn't require regular commitment from drivers. It's so successful 13 other faith communities in Orlando have adopted it. But Stickle worries people rely too much on volunteers.
When the city can't, when the county can't, when the federal government can't, when the private nonprofits can't, they turn to the faith communities. And then, unfortunately, we become overwhelmed with the burden of responsibility.
Voluntary organizations are under pressure, and public mass transit and private non-profit services also face a funding squeeze. However, advocates for the elderly agree more time and money needs to be invested to help seniors stay mobile. For 90.7 WMFE News, I'm Matthew Petty.
And joining me now is 90.7's Matthew Petty to further explain the challenges seniors are facing as they lose their ability to drive. You know, Matt, how big is the scope of this challenge, providing transportation for seniors?
Well, as you heard in the piece, it's a pretty big problem. Essentially, public transport, volunteers, and the private non-profit car service I talked to are all pretty swamped at the moment. What they do is they don't even advertise their service, because if they did, they would be simply unable to cope. And they've told me that the problem's only going to get worse as the baby boomers get older. Here's how ITN's Kimber Threet describes it.
I think we forgot that we would age. And I think even more so, we forgot that a very huge population, which are the baby boomers, would eventually inherit this problem. They are a group of people that are still on the go. They're very active. They are not the seniors of the past. And unfortunately, health conditions, health problems will render some of them immobile before they made plans to be immobile.
So Threet talks about how many people use her service. Essentially, 300 people are subscribed, about 260 people use it regularly. But she says there's a much bigger demand than that. Essentially, ITN operates within the Metro Orlando area, and she's getting calls daily from people who say, we'd like you to come out to where we are. One of the areas she talked about was down near SeaWorld. Apparently, there's a big demand for this kind of service down there. But at the moment, they just don't have the resources to provide that service. Now, in the piece, you also heard from Access Links director Bill Herndon, and he says also that demand for Access Links has climbed in the last 6 years. So about 6 years ago, in 2006, there were about 600 requests per month for the service, and that's climbed to, in 2011, more than 1,000. Now, what Links tries to do is it tries to get people off using the door-to-door Access Links service into its regular bus routes, and they have a training program, in fact, where they'll take people who want to use Access Links and see if they can actually physically use the regular bus service, and if they find that they're able to do that, they'll teach them how to do it. Because, of course, some senior people, some elderly people have never actually used public transit before, and they may feel a little bit fearful of getting on a bus. So Access Links will actually take them and show them how to use it.
Now, Matt, we heard also from your reporting that one of the major destinations for seniors is along that Orange Avenue Medical Corridor. And, of course, SunRail, the commuter line for Central Florida, is set to start rolling in 2014. So how's that going to impact the transportation picture for seniors who aren't able to drive?
Well, clearly, Mark, SunRail is going to be a pretty important part of mass transit for the Central Florida area in the future. Of course, as you know, it sort of runs along the spine of Orlando. It goes about 60 miles all the way from Poinciana to DeLand, or it will when it's completed. Now, what it will do is it'll take, of course, well, the thought is that it'll take some of the congestion off I-4. So you heard from Bill Herndon from Access Links talking about how that actually has a pretty profound impact on their ability to get out and about and complete their service effectively. So that should create some impact there. And, of course, Mr. Herndon told me that he expects ridership on Access Links will actually increase, because the thought is that there will be more seniors riding SunRail, and they'll be using SunRail for the longer trips, and then the ridership on Access Links will increase as well.
Did you get the sense that Access Links is ready to handle additional capacity?
Well, they have a plan in place to get ready to do that. Of course, what they have to do is, where there are fixed bus routes, they actually have to, by law, they're required to provide that door-to-door service. So Links itself, the main sort of fixed bus routes, they are going to be beefing up their routes around those SunRail stops. And when they do, Access Links will have to, in tandem, then provide the door-to-door service around those routes.
And it's clear that the Access Links, that's a separate service, a different approach that Links is taking from the actual increase of bus routes around SunRail itself for everybody else.
That's correct. I mean, of course, the thing about Access Links is it gets funding from three different sources. It gets some Medicaid funding for Medicaid passengers. It also has some funding for an organization under an umbrella known as Transportation Disadvantaged. And then there's also the Americans with Disability Act. That's actually an unfunded mandate. So what they have to do is they have to provide that service out of funds going into Links, the Links service itself. And as you heard, funding's a pretty critical issue for Links. They basically have to go, as Mr. Herndon put it, cap in hand to the Tri-County authorities to get money every year.
Now, Links isn't the only transport organization that's facing challenges.
That's correct. ITN, who you heard from in the piece, are facing something along the lines of a $80,000 funding shortfall this year. They have to go to different organizations for grants and the like. They also raise a bit of money themselves. So they're facing a bit of a funding squeeze. And they tell me that public transit may not be the answer. As you may have gleaned, some elderly folks aren't that keen on using public transit. I mean, some people may have moved down from the north of the country, from cities where they do have a pretty well-established mass transit network. But other folks, you know, once they hit the age of 75 or so and they find they can't drive anymore, they may be faced with having to use public transit for the first time. And many people just don't want to do that. They would rather use a private car service, taxis, or something where they feel that, you know, they can sort of get in a car and go wherever they want, whenever they want. And that's kind of a critical issue for something like ITN.
We're talking with 90.7's Matthew Petty, getting a little more insight into his reporting on the challenges seniors are facing as they lose their ability to drive in Central Florida. Now, Matt, you also profiled volunteer organizations that are providing transit services to seniors. What did you find out about how those operations are run?
Well, Mark, one of the people I talked to was Peggy Stickle. Now, she organises a volunteer car service for the elderly, and that's based out of St. Margaret Mary Church in Winter Park. And she says the down economy is hurting the volunteer model.
The landscape right now is very difficult because so many people have gone back to work. You need a group or a faith community that's relatively affluent so that they, first of all, can afford to do it, but separately, that the people are home during the day. Not just that they can afford to pay for their own gas, but they are physically available. And you get into some neighborhoods where everyone's working, it's an impossible situation.
So Peggy Stickle there talking about essentially in her neighborhood, which is in Winter Park, it's a fairly well-to-do neighborhood. They have a pretty good base of volunteers, something on the lines of 100 for this service. And the thing is, they have enough volunteers that they don't have to make a regular commitment, so they can volunteer maybe once a month. But effectively, she's saying that you need to have a place where people do actually have the time and the ability to get out and do that volunteering. And in neighborhoods, poorer neighborhoods, where you don't have that base of retirees who are able to, you know, donate their time and resources, then it's pretty difficult to run this volunteer model. So although a lot of the times people do turn to churches, faith organizations, other voluntary models to try and help seniors get out and about, it's not always going to work. It's not the best model to follow.
And this also kind of touches on some issues of community design and walkability, whether or not primary services are within walking distance as well.
That's correct. I mean, one of the things I think probably Central Florida will have to look to in the long term is just the way that communities are designed. Of course, as you know, in Central Florida, if you want to get out and about, do business, pretty much anything else, you have to have a motor car. You have to be able to drive a long way, sometimes, you know, maybe an hour or two commute either way if you're going to and from work. And the same applies to people who are retired and need to go to the doctor, go to the grocer, the dentist, just, you know, get out and about and socialize too. You really have to think about the way those communities will be designed in the future. I mean, that could get around some of these transportation issues that are facing seniors now. If communities were a little more compact with ready access to all the essential services within a couple of mile radius.
That's 90.7's Matthew Petty. He also writes for the reporting project Transportation Nation, which you can find links to on our website, WMFE.org. Matt, thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome, Mark.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.